Morning, everyone. It's nice to see a few of you. So welcome to the First Universalist Unitarian Church. My name is Brian Mason, and I serve as minister in this congregation. I think all of you know that, though, at least all of you here. I want to extend a special welcome, and also a special welcome to those of you who are joining us online. You all have heard this before, but I'm proud of it. Since 1870, this church has served as a vital voice for liberal religion in central Wisconsin. We are an intentionally free society that welcomes all people just as you are, regardless of age, sexual orientation, gender expression, ethnicity, or economic situation. Wherever you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. Worshiping in a pandemic is tricky, so let me give you a few very brief reminders before we get underway. Number one, keep your mask on at all times to protect yourself and your neighbor. I or another speaker may take ours off briefly when we're speaking, but you'll notice once we're done, we put them right back on, and none of you get within lots of feet of us anyways. Maintain 6 feet of distance from your neighbors. In a space like this, we might as well be outside, so I don't think that's going to be a problem. When you greet one another, instead of offering a handshake, I suggest to you offer a reverent bow instead, or maybe air high-five them from 6 feet or more away. You are welcome to follow along and read or recite the chalice lighting and the affirmation, but please refrain from singing. But that said, everything I've read seems to suggest that humming is just fine so long as you actually know the tune. Finally, once again, thank you so much for being here. It's wonderful to see the top half of a few of your faces. And also for those of you who are joining us online, I want you to know that your spirit is felt here this morning. So if you want to take just a moment and turn around and greet your neighbors, you're welcome to do that. You can wave at everybody or give them an air high five. Okay. And if you would, please join me in reciting our chalice lighting. If you picked up an order of service on your way in, you can follow along, or some of you have probably memorized it by this point. And the words begin, "We light this chalice for the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the fire of commitment. We light this symbol of our faith as we gather together." Donica.
And go.
welcome to join me in reciting an affirmation. This affirmation comes from this church's original worship book. It wasn't called a hymn book, it was a worship book. So hear our ancestors' voices in these words. And as I said, you're welcome to read along. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow into harmony with the divine. Thus do we covenant with each other. And now our doxology.
Morning. I'm Julie Trombley, and I'm the Director of Religious Education here in this congregation. And today I have a story for you about Jonah and a whale. It's a story for Yom Kippur. This is a very old story. It's been told many times, but this particular telling was written by Rebecca Kelly Morgan, who is the Director of Religious Education at Winchester Unitarian Society in Massachusetts. Yom Kippur is a special day for Jewish people everywhere. It's a time to say, I'm sorry, and a time to say, I forgive you. And on Yom Kippur in the afternoon, a story from the holy book, the Torah, is told. It's about a man named Jonah, a big storm, a big fish, and a happy ending. God wanted Jonah to become a teacher and teach the people goodness and kindness. Jonah would have to go far away and give up everything he had. Jonah said, "No way." Probably more than once, but God was persistent. So, finding a boat going in the opposite direction, Jonah sailed away, hoping to outrun God and this calling to be a teacher. For a while, it was all smooth sailing, but then clouds started to come and the rain started to fall, and very soon, a huge, gigantic storm threatened to sink the boat that Jonah was on. Jonah knew that the storm was because he had run away from doing what God asked him to do. Something had to be done. The people on the boat were afraid, so over the side of the boat, Jonah went. Everything became calm. The sun came out again, and the boat sailed on. But what happened to Jonah? Before Jonah could sink into the ocean, a big fish, a whale of a fish, swallowed him up and dove beneath the waves. And there was Jonah in the stomach of a whale. He was wet. It was dark, and it smelled like fish in there. But he wasn't hurt. And with nothing to do but wait for something to happen, Jonah thought about what kind of person he had been. He thought about the kind of person God had asked him to be. Jonah thought about these things for 3 days and three nights. Or maybe it only seemed like 3 days and three nights, because Jonah couldn't see the sky or the sun or the stars. Now, we weren't there, but it is said that in the dark belly of the whale, Jonah talked to God. After a long, long time, Jonah said, and he really, really meant it, "I'm sorry, and please forgive me." And in the silence that followed, the whale gave a big, belchy burp and spit Jonah out onto dry land and then disappeared beneath the waves. The sun came out, and Jonah looked up and saw it, and Jonah gave thanks. But most importantly, Jonah realized that he'd become closer to becoming the becoming the kind of person that he wanted to be. And the next time God asked him to go far away to teach goodness and kindness, Jonah said, yes. Today, we tell this story because what Jonah learned is something that all of us could learn. To say, I'm sorry, and to forgive each other. And that's the end of the whale and the end of my tale. And now we'll sing our children's song. Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is so sacred to many of us, a community of memory and hope. There are four ways that you can give donations to us right at this moment. If you're here in person, there is a basket out on the greeter's table, and you're welcome to drop something in there as you leave today. You can also go to our website under the Contact tab and donate on our website. You can also text First UU WASA to 73256. And of course, you can always mail a check. Today's reading is titled, To Be of Use, and it's by Marge Piercy. The people I love the best jump into work headfirst, without dallying in the shallows, and swim off with such sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals, bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals or field deserters, but move in a common rhythm, when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is as common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphors for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real.
I'd like to invite all of you now into a spirit of prayer and meditation. You can start by putting both feet on the ground, if you're so inclined. If you pray with your eyes closed, go ahead and close them. If you leave them open, that's okay. Take a breath. Feel your heart and your chest. Feel the gift of other people in this room. And let us journey into silence with these words. Compassionate, creating spirit of life, forgiver of the angry whose pain slips out of sight when the light turns green, lover of the dedicated souls too busy to do good works, to help the stranger. A commitment to us was made 150 years ago through the life and death of our spiritual ancestors who came before us in this church. By this covenant, we are called to claim our heritage. And so, holy source of life, help us to open our hearts to those in need. Hear now our prayers for those whose lives are pain, for those whose hopes are ashes, for those whose joy has fallen from the tree of life before the harvest is complete. And now call to mind the joys and sorrows in your own heart. And let us join together for a time of silent meditation now. Amen. One of the gifts of being a father is the chance I get to relive childhood through my daughter's life. I especially enjoy how rich her inner world is. And lately she's been curious about plumbing, probably because I had to replace some pipes in the faucet in my kitchen just a few weeks back. But this simple topic has grown and now includes the central nervous system and veins and sanitation standards. And her changing curiosities often have a musical playlist. And this one is set to Evan Rachel Wood singing All Is Found from Frozen 2. Maybe you've heard of that movie before. And when the song's not being blasted from the Alexa in our dining room, my daughter is playing it herself on the piano in our living room. Her imagination is often formed by what she's reading. For instance, this summer, she and I read through most of C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia. And so I often found her checking in one of the closets in the house to see if a door to Narnia was there or not. And just a couple of weeks back, she started reading the Harry Potter series with my wife, and we have yet to see how it will shape her interests and her imagination, but I have no doubts that it's going to shape it in some way. My daughter, in a way, sort of lives in the stories she reads, often talking about the characters and narratives as if they're real people and events in life. And in many ways, I am very envious of this. For me, there's almost nowhere I would rather be than home with my family sharing stories. But for as much as I love this, I've noticed that when I'm reading, and sometimes even whenever I'm having dinner, I'm twitchy. And the only way this twitchiness goes away is if I grab my phone and check for new messages or headlines. I wonder if anybody else has this problem. Okay, I guess I'm alone. Well, the sermon's for me then this morning. It's almost as if I'm uncomfortable with life, so I need a virtual life to feel normal. It's sort of like my phone, in some ways, is a drug, and it's the only thing that can give me the fix I need to refocus on reading or a conversation. Now, before I lose anyone, let me be clear. This is not a sermon about how we should stop using technology. I am not going to suggest to you this morning that you delete Facebook or whatever or throw away your iPhone. So to be clear, what I'm talking about this morning is tranquility. So consider this. A few years ago, a tweet by Jason Gay, who is a writer for the Wall Street Journal, it went viral. And here is what Jason Gay's tweet said, and I quote, "There's a guy in this coffee shop sitting at a table, not on his phone, not on a laptop, just drinking coffee, like a psychopath." So let's deconstruct this like the philosophers say. In the 21st century, the presence of someone not on a phone or a computer or a tablet isn't an outward sign of inward tranquility. Rather, it's an outward sign of inner psychosis. So for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume that on some level, you agree with me that many people are just a bit wrapped up in their phones or their computers or their TVs. No one's shaking their head no, audience online, okay? Everybody is going along with this assumption. I'm also going to assume that to some extent, all of us desire a more tranquil mind. No one's shaking their head no here either. I don't think it's controversial to say that we live in an age of information overload with constant noise and chatter. Almost everywhere we go, demands are placed on our attention, and often we give our attention away without even questioning it. And so rather than think about the book we're reading or how magical the Wisconsin River looks in the fall, we skitter around to whatever's on the nearest screen, which is often the one right in our hands. So when I started thinking about this sermon, I noticed that my own attention is constantly assaulted. Now, for instance, and maybe some of you have noticed this, at a not-to-be-named gas station chain here in town, whenever you pump your gas, a screen comes on, and it starts selling you first two hot dogs for $1, which is a screaming deal because I love hot dogs, but then it switches to a news flash about a celebrity or a politician. Another example. On the last flight I took shortly before the pandemic, I let down my tray table to put my stuff on there to get situated. And even on my tray table, it was papered with an advertisement. In the seats, all the seats, even on the most tiny puddle jumpers, it seems like they all have a screen on the seat right in front of you that try to sell you Wi-Fi or in-flight television, because heaven knows traveling at 500 miles an hour at 35,000 feet is just too boring. And in the airport, whenever I try to read the book, I can barely concentrate because what's all around you? TVs on full blast showing CNN or Fox News, switching from headline to headline to breaking news to breaking news. So the point I'm trying to make is this. Attention, our attention, is a resource we only have so much of. And like any valuable resource, we should be mindful of how it's used. Because the fact is, just as clean air is required for us to breathe, silence is required for us to think. And silence and tranquility are ancient concerns. They're not just unique to our time. The Roman poet Horace asked in his writings, and I quote, this question: what brings tranquility? So what Horace wants to figure out is a way to protect us from the chatter so prevalent in modern life. In other words, Horace wants to know, and he engages with us in a poetic discourse, what he wants to know is how we can live a life caring a little bit less. So he talks about this, as I said, in a poetic conversation with a very distracted friend of his named Lollius Maximus. Now, us moderns, we like to think that our concerns are so unique and that our lives are so special and that our thinking is so woke. But if we actually read old books, we'd learn that we are not nearly as advanced as we like to think we are. Way back in 65, before the Common Era, Horace talks about the exact same things that distract us now. And what are they? Obsession with money. Those pesky things that harass us when we're trying to nod off to sleep. Being stuck on a loop, going from thought to thought, emotion to emotion, without the ability to slow down and concentrate on one thing at a time. Tell me some of this sounds familiar. Of course it sounds familiar. It's called Twitter, or Facebook, or a phone call with my sister Stephanie. That's a joke, she'll get it. Now, Horace wasn't some sage that people hiked into mountains to consult. Horace was like all of us and took full advantage of being a resident in a modern city. I'd be willing to bet that if Horace were alive today, he would definitely have an iPhone, and he would be up to date on politics and pop culture too. And this is exactly why I think Horace is helpful, because he very much enjoyed life in a modern, exciting, and at times a scandalous world. Horace gets us. So in order to calm the mind in the midst of a storm of distractions, Horace tells us this, and I quote, "Interrogate the writings of the wise." How do we calm down? Interrogate the writings of the wise. Horace says we need to spend less time with the news and our social networks, and instead we need to schedule time each day to read old books and have communion with ancient thinkers or big questions. He says that we should fight our compulsions and addictions for trivial things and instead fill our minds with questions that really and truly matter. Questions like, what is the virtuous life? Now I'm going to ask rhetorically, how many of you sat around this past week reading Aristotle or Jane Austen contemplating the virtuous life? No one raised their hand. Now, how many of you sat around and at one time or another got angry about politics, or you zoned out on Twitter or Facebook. Yeah, okay, every single person raised their hand except the people lying. So Horace doesn't expect that any of us in spending time with the ancestors will solve humanity's enduring questions, right? Let that get through your mind. He doesn't expect that any of us will solve the enduring questions. But if we learn to fill our minds with some of those questions, if only for a few moments, we push away what Alan Jacobs calls the tyranny of anxieties. Those things that follow us from app to app, screen to screen, Instagram to TikTok, Facebook to Twitter. Horace tells us that in the midst of modern life, with countless distractions, if we really want to care less about trivial stuff, if we really want to have a more tranquil mind, then we have to learn how to have one eye on the eternal and the other eye on the everyday at the exact same time. But Horace's suggestion, I will freely admit, like everything in the 21st century, is a controversial suggestion. Recent articles like, "Should We Cancel Aristotle?" or "Kill Bill, Why We Must Take Shakespeare Out of the Classroom?" capture a modern impulse in society that goes like this. I'm going to summarize. Writers like Edith Wharton, Aristotle, Dostoevsky, and hundreds more had thoughts or wrote things that are contrary to modern understandings about sexuality or race or whatever, and therefore they have nothing of value in today's world. The assumption is we, us moderns, we have advanced beyond their limited worldviews. Now let me be clear so I don't end up getting canceled myself. I think writers of the past should be judged by modern standards. Is that clear? Dismissing racism or misogyny is bad. You shouldn't do that. But the point of reading isn't to bring a writer's idea into our world. As the author Brian Morton says, when we pick up an old novel, we're not bringing the novelist into our world and deciding whether or not he or she is enlightened enough to belong here. We're journeying into the novelist's world, and we are taking a look around. In other words, the author is not a guest at our table. We are a guest at hers. The risk in shrinking the pool of thinkers to only those whose ideas meet 21st century standards is that we shrink the size of our own pool so small that it has only a very specific scope, when in reality, what are we doing? We're just narrowing the scope of our own minds into a tiny, manageable unit of thinkers and writers who are doing what? They're basically saying the exact same thing. If most of history and the history of ideas ends up being regarded with cynicism, we are in effect denying a fact of humanity. And this is the fact. All of us are irregular and changeable. And most of us shy away from our best and most noble ideas. Our universalist ancestors, the people who built this church, would have called it this. They would have called it sin. Now, how much do you want to bet me that 50 to 100 years from now, people will look back on us for not caring or protesting about the millions of animals we kill every year to eat? How many of you think 50 to 100 years from now, our offspring are going to look back on us and the thousands of tons of pollution we dump into the air, the millions of tons of trash we produce every year, or the millions of children we let go hungry every single day? I can guarantee you that if that's the only measure of our generation, every single one of us will deserve to get canceled too. So let me offer a too short example of this using a history of our nation. Many of the people who formed this union, who put equality on the marquee, they owned slaves. It's undeniable. It's documented. And many of them, though not all of them, had terrible, reprehensible ideas about women and children and so on. And that is unacceptable. But some of those same people gave us ideas that have pushed not just our nation, but also the entire world a little closer to that original vision of freedom and justice. And now ask yourself, of how many of us can the same thing be said? The American philosopher John Dewey believed that innovation requires continuity with the past, and that in order to innovate, we have to hold on to what we've inherited rather than discarding it. Dewey believed that innovation is possible only when we actually sift through the past, and by that he meant its wickedness and its wisdom. And this isn't just a job for scholars and lawyers and preachers. In Dewey's mind, this was everyone's job. I often find myself wondering how many atheists have actually read the Bible, or John Calvin, or Julian of Norwich. How many of those same atheists do you think, before they made up their minds, read the Quran or the Torah before they rejected belief in the divine? Now I'm going to flip the script. How many Christians do you think read Nietzsche or Simone de Beauvoir to find out actually what some non-religious ethics is all about? Richard Rohr tells us the only way you can usefully criticize anything is by unlocking it from the inside. Throwing rocks from the outside is far too easy, and ultimately, it is pointless. We are all free to accept prepackaged arguments, or we can actually dig in and find out for ourselves what thinkers before us have said about living a meaningful and virtuous life. And if for nothing else, learning to care less like this will add to your own personal density. I don't think it's healthy to go through life assuming we know what the past or the other side believes. I think assumptions like this have in fact led to an undeniable cynicism at work in the world today, one that has weaponized some histories and some ideas. Discrediting ideas and people who have them because they fail a modern standard, or because we the living have failed to live up to them, is a stone's throw from ignorance. Just think if we used this exact same kind of logic about families and relationships, and we gave up on our parents, or we gave up on love whenever someone fell short of their commitments to us. How many of you think that you would actually have a friend left in this world if this same logic was used to assess your life? But none of this is possible unless we learn to live more like the psychopath in the coffee shop. Now, people, and especially Unitarian Universalists, love to say the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice, which is basically a statement about what? It's a statement about the future. And I think that the statement does have poetic merit, but in reality, the future is nothing more than a hope, or better yet, nothing more than faith in something that does not exist. If I were to bet on the best way to shape the moral arc of the universe, I sure as hell wouldn't put it on Washington, D.C., or Silicon Valley, or Wall Street. In my mind, the best investment we can make in the future is in the minds and living of our children. But in order to do this, we have to accept responsibility for the fact that the world they're so naturally curious about is given character and content by the lives we are living right now, and also by the character and content of our shared history. A lot of history is filled with whole eras of people getting it wrong or mucking it up, or falling short of their own visions for equity and freedom. But alongside those pages are characters and chapters filled with imperfect people who got a bit right. I don't want to package the world into a narrow set of ideas for my daughter. I don't want her to know that running through all of life are winds and songs and veins, from cave paintings to ancient Christians, to little girls hiding in attics in Nazi Germany, to preachers who fought racism with nonviolence, to slavery and freedom. I also want my daughter to know that those same Puritans who people like to call backward, those same Puritans built colleges that allowed women and men to learn together. I want her to find out that the same preacher who preached the sermon that said we are all sinners in the hands of an angry God, that same preacher believed that that same God loves stones and animals and people and music just as much as she does. I want her to know that some people who gave humanity beautiful ideas and art and music probably had a dumb thought or worse along the way, and that some people with the best ideas are ignored in their lifetime. I want her to live in a world where it's quiet enough for her to think for herself. But most of all, I want her to crack open the door of the past wide enough so that she'll learn our kinship to it is something she can decide for herself. And yes, she will find some narrow-mindedness alongside the wisdom. But I'm going to tell her that her mind is vast enough to take it all in. I want her to do this so that she'll learn how to have a more tranquil mind, as Horace suggested. But I also want her to do this because doing this is an act of love. All of us will be a part of history one day. And I hope and I pray for everyone's sake that there will be someone willing to extend to us a love that recognizes the fact that even though we have gone astray, within us is a deep humanity too. Amen. Donica. Reach out with your hearts today and every day. May the truth that sets us free and the hope that never dies, the love that casts out fear, lead us forward together until the day spring breaks. and all shadows flee away. You're welcome to remain seated through the postlude. Once again, it's wonderful to see all of you. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Packers game tonight. Packers, take it away, Margaret.